Three. Oops. Sorry about that, Reg. How you, I was already. I didn't even say hi to you yet. I was already going to do the intro. Oh, good thing no one ever hears any of this behind the scenes stuff, right? They just hear the stuff after that countdown, right? Please don't ever release the unedited stuff. This little banter between us, the real foolish me will come through. Anyway, okay, my friend, are you ready to get started? Okay, let's do it. I promise I will do it correctly this time. I won't do the countdown before I say hi to you and we get everything set. How rude of me. How silly of me. How I don't even know what the word is. But I'm glad I caught myself. Okay. All right. Are you ready to go? I am too. Good. Now let's do this thing. Put it in the books. Number 431. Three S's, star, smile, strong. And now I'll do the countdown. Okay. And you give me the music and I'll give you the podcast. Okay. Here we go. Didn't mean to be rude there, Reg. Here we go. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNradio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And don't forget, it's important to listen to the podcast, but it's also important to become an ambassador for the podcast, become an advocate for the podcast, become a voice for the podcast. So get out there, tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. And of course, if you like what you hear, you can always listen to these podcasts 24 hours a day, at your convenience, wherever you want to do, as long as you are connected to some kind of device. Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic is connected to you. Go to WGNradio.com, go to the podcast section, go to the prompt for this podcast, and there they are. Scroll down and load more. Years and years worth of podcasts. We've been doing this since May of 2016. This is podcast 431. So, always sad when somebody you know or you respect or you admire or you feel like you know, certainly when it comes to a public figure, someone who's been able to connect with the masses over some kind of a platform, today certainly, many platforms to connect to people with, but wasn't always the case. And those who had that ability, over the few that existed, say, 30 or 40 years ago, radio, television, that's about it, really. I mean, films, movies, right? Yeah, you know, but it really wasn't until the internet began to become entrenched in the mid-90s when all of a sudden there were just the technology boom just exploded, and so many offshoots from the internet have become now commonplace. And we have new designations, right? We have social media. We have viral videos. I mean, now you just say Instagram and TikTok, and those are platforms. Those are, when you say TikTok or Instagram or even Facebook, not so much anymore, but TikTok certainly is as powerful, is as far-reaching as television or radio ever have been, and perhaps in the future ever will be, considering just how many people watch and contribute content to TikTok. It's really a phenomenon. And I'm sure there are going to be more phenomena. There used to be, they're not, the word phenomenon always had a lot of importance and cachet to it. There's a lot of phenomenons happening now. It just seems as if everything, and you hear people say this all the time, but it's all relative. I'm sure people in the 1900s, when suddenly there was the emergence of, vehicles like trains and the steam engine and later the car and things like this, if you were used to using push carts and horses, you had to say, wow, the world is moving faster these days. With any kind of innovation, with any kind of technology, there's always speed, always seems to be the key element of it. Not only is the goal with technology to do something more efficiently or more conveniently, but certainly speed plays into it. And we have sped up our culture and our society so much in the last 125 years that, it's you got to strap in. You got to grab on. This is a supersonic jet now, our society. It's moving fast. It's taking no prisoners. If you're not jumping on, you're falling off and you're way behind. I mention all this because I was very sad to hear of the passing of one of, I consider, a legend in television and broadcasting and journalism. And given my my background in the media and journalism, he had special meaning to me, but he was also an entertainer, and he was a huge pop culture figure for many years. And I bring up the topic of how fast we're moving today, because by moving so fast forward, by consuming everything so quickly and spitting it out and moving on to the next thing, we are slowly, and once again, I hate to sound like a 100-year-old man, but we are really not only losing history, we are losing an appreciation for history. We are losing a recognition of history. And I'm a huge history buff. I'm a big fan of history. I'm a big fan of looking back at history to learn lessons, because while technology has pushed our society forward and quickly and never wants to look back, as I've said on this podcast many times, as human beings, yes, our society has changed immensely because of what technology has enabled us to do. But at the same time, human nature, human beings, human behavior has not changed all that much in thousands of years, perhaps billions of years, however long man has been around. As I've said many times, that's one reason why Shakespeare plays remain relevant today, even though they were written 500-600 years ago. The basic plots, the basic motivations of Shakespeare remain, sadly, I mean, thankfully, they're great plays. We get to enjoy them and we can relate to them. But sadly, we can relate to them, because human behavior, even in the last 500 years, hasn't changed all that much, as these plays prove. Ambition, jealousy, lust, you name it. Insecurity. Mental disease, All of the human emotions are on display in Shakespeare plays, and they're still on display in our behavior. We have moved, certainly, as a culture from what we used to be, very barbaric, very ignorant. As a whole, we've moved that way, but at the same time, we know this. There is still ignorance, there is still barbarism, there is still violence. Some of those elements that have been defining elements and defining traits of the human species are still with us, and we battle against them every day. I, as I said many times, I would love to see someone from 1900, for instance, to come down, to be able to come back and look at the culture and just spend a day following a person in their daily lives, in their daily behaviors, waking up with electricity and waking up with, maybe an alarm clock, an electric alarm clock, or waking up and going, the first thing you do is going to your cell phone, and we already know the capabilities of that, or turning on a television, or turning on a radio, or getting in our cars, or using our refrigerators, our refrigeration, or using our electric stoves. What we take for granted with almost mindless flicks of switches and mindless gestures of reflex actions of grabbing something, one of the things I just mentioned would be almost incomprehensible to them. What are you talking about? What do you mean this? You flick a switch and a light goes on. What are you talking about? All in every room in every house? What are you talking about? What do you mean? There may have been, I'm using 1900 just as a random date. There may have been some of this stuff, but it certainly wasn't mass. It wasn't used with the everyday usage that we do. Some people may have had electricity, or there may have been the roots of it being developed, and people may have heard of it, but it certainly wasn't used like it is today. And at the same time, while they would be shocked and just amazed by the technology and the conveniences that we have, they would probably be a little disappointed. While I think the awe and the shock of what we are able to do, it would just blow their minds. And then I think what would make them very sad and depressed is what we are not able to do after all that time. And we are still not able to really get along. We are still not able to look past race. We are still not able to treat each other in a kind way. Many of those prejudicial and violent and ambition and all the other emotions that make up human behavior still exist. And we're working at it. And maybe it's just in our DNA. Who knows? But so it's an interesting dichotomy there. I'm bringing this all up because it makes me think, because of the passing, as I said, of who I felt was somebody who really tried to change things and really did try to shed light and shed knowledge and fight against ignorance and fight against prejudice and engage people and have people talking and coming together, as opposed to being isolated, as opposed to being tribalistic. It's really a credit to him, and I believe that, as I said, in this fast consuming, spit it out, chew it up and spit it out society, we have lost not only a sense of history, but an appreciation for and a recognition of history, because we're always looking ahead and we don't really put much value in what happened before. And so I was very saddened by the passing of a trailblazing broadcaster, a trailblazing journalist named Phil Donahue. If you are probably over the age of 50, I think you certainly know who Phil Donahue was. If you're under the age of 50, certainly I think if you're, 45 or younger, you may have heard the name, but you're really not familiar with him. And I'm sure if you're under 30, you have no idea who Phil Donahue is, and you don't care who Phil Donahue is, which that's really the sad aspect of that entire little example. And that's one reason why I want to talk about Phil Donahue today. To either, if you are a younger listener, I'd love you to educate you a little on this very important figure in our society who has just passed away. And you should appreciate his contribution, because many of the things that you like or that you admire in today's world were influenced by this man. Believe it or not, there is some value to what came before you. There were a lot of people around doing important things before you were born, and it's important for you to know about those things. Just as it's important for older people to remember those who may have not be in the zeitgeist anymore, or may not be in the public eye anymore, but remember when you were around and you experienced some of the things that these people did. It's good for you to recall those and say that, wow, you know what? Oh, I forgot about that. Yes, I used to. You were a big fan of the Phil Donahue show, perhaps. But maybe that hasn't occurred to you in a while, and you go, yeah, I used to watch that every day. But Phil Donahue passed away. He was 88 years old. For many people, he was maybe known over the last several years best as the husband of Marlo Thomas. And people might say, who's Marlo Thomas? I mean, you get a certain age. You see this now because of the St. Jude's Hospital, and she appears on many of the commercials, because her father, a former entertainer of many decades ago, called Danny Thomas, founded the St. Jude's Hospital, which you see commercials for, which helps treat infant and young children with cancer free of charge, and that's why they raise money. The goal of that hospital is to help the families with children who have cancer, to take the financial burden off of them. They house them and they treat them, and that's why their budgets are in the billions. But Marlo Thomas at one time was a very popular actress. Once again, people of a certain age will remember that Marlo Thomas was a star of a show of a 60s, very popular 60s show called That Girl, where she played aspiring actress Anne Marie. And she was a very pretty little pixie kind of a character. Very popular, That Girl. You could see it on video, I'm sure. I mean, video. You could see it on YouTube or whatever. But Marlo Thomas, because she not only was, became a TV star in her own right, but then also the daughter of a famous entertainer, Danny Thomas, she was certainly a popular celebrity in the 70s and 80s, and wound up meeting Phil Donahue as a guest on his show. And I'll talk about that more. But what happened was the two met when she was a guest on his show. She's a well-known celebrity of the time. She appeared on his show for some reason, promote something, whatever. And apparently the chemistry was immediate. And it sounds as if the story that they tell, they almost fell in love that day when she appeared on his show, and they wound up being married for more than 45 years. But before I tell you that story, but like I said, that was one of the things he was best known for, was simply his marriage. But believe me, Phil Donahue should be remembered for much, much more. He played a vital role in the development of television and how television presented topics, news, and how it, and most importantly, how television would engage with people. That was a different word. You know, from the beginning of television, television was always an entertainment medium. It was a mix of entertainment, mostly at the time when television first started, transitioning the entertainers who were popular on radio for several decades because of their popularity on the radio, because of their instant audience, or their large audiences. They were the first people recruited to be on television because they were well-known names here in the United States, at least, to bring an audience to television, this new medium. Visual, as I've said many times in this podcast, we are a visual species, and television was a huge game changer. Just, you know, in the late 40s when television first started, and then, you know, 55 years later, we had the internet, which was another major game changer. There have been some other significant technologies in the communications world that have helped to expand our scope of communicating and sending pictures and sending out news and sending out entertainment. But, you know, there's radio, but television being visual was the game changer. And then what the internet did ultimately was not only a global connectivity, which television had via satellites, but it was instant, and even most importantly, it was personal. Those other mediums, radio and television, yes, they broadcast around the world. They kept people entertained. They kept people informed. But they were also run by a certain group of people. What the internet did was strip away that layer and give people the power to send a message anytime they wanted, to whomever they wanted. And now, with the capabilities to watch anything we want, wherever, whenever, however, because of the power of the smartphone. But there's no question that television, when it came along, was one of those game-changing, historic technologies that would change the world forever. But basically, it did two things. It entertained people, just like radio did, and it informed people with the news. And in fact, television news was, and I talked about this last week a little bit when I was talking about my current play network, in that television news at one time was almost a public trust. It was the way that the networks initially got their licenses to, they had to promise that they would not just use this to entertain, but they would actually have a responsibility to the public to also use it in the public good, to have news, to inform people, to keep people aware. So it wasn't just all frivolous, dancing and singing and comedy and clowns and whatever, that there would also be a vital public good. And that's how the news on television was born. And it was that way for several decades. And yes, there were other talk shows before. There were talk shows during the day, in the morning. The Today Show is one of the oldest talk shows in history. Meet the Press is one of the oldest television shows in history. We certainly had talk shows. As I said, the Today Show was informative. It was this early morning mix of a radio type of format, which some of the news shows today still have. Some news, some hard news, and then some kind of light things, you know, with pets and food recipes and lighter things and fashion and all that. And then there's just out and out entertainment. Many news programs in the morning especially have almost like standalone comedy bits Or little round table discussions with the hosts, just kind of letting their hair down and talking about what's going on. Well, especially that little panel, that little sitting around talking, that's not new, but that has its roots in what Phil Donahue did. Phil Donahue was a journalist. He was from Ohio. He got his start there as a journalist and a broadcaster. He had a local television show in Dayton, Ohio in the mid-60s. And whether it may have been a happy mistake, it may have been a well-calculated move. But what distinguished Phil Donahue and what made him a trailblazing legend, in my opinion, is that since television's introduction, especially in this kind of a talk show genre, you had the host and you had the guests. And many times, that's all you had on a TV set, a guest with the host. And they talked. Then as time went on, someone said, well, wouldn't it be interesting just to have an audience to be able to react and clap and, you know, give a little another dimension. And so suddenly talk shows had an audience. But they didn't participate. They were there more as window dressing. They were more there to give some kind of an energy to the show, with some reactions, laughing if there was something funny, clapping if there was something. You'd hear them. You'd hear the audience. But you didn't see them. First, on the Tonight Show, the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson was on for 30 years. For the most part, you heard the audience, but you rarely saw them. Every so often, Johnny would do a bit, little skit where he would go out into the audience and either ask them questions or they did stump the band. But it wasn't a regular part of the show. The audience was there passively. They were not there to interact. They were not in there to participate. They were there to react. They were there to observe. They weren't part of the show. They were an element within the production of it, but they didn't participate. They didn't make or break the show on a nightly basis with, for instance, the Tonight Show or a nighttime talk show. And the same way with daytime shows. So I said, there were many celebrities and many people who had daytime shows, but there wasn't an interaction with the audience. The audience was there to observe. They were passive. They weren't active. And what Phil Donahue did, as I said, now, I mean, when I've read things about Phil Donahue, he makes it sound like it was a happy accident that, you know, he had a small studio audience in his Phil Donahue Show studio in Ohio. And rather than sitting on the set in a chair interviewing his guest, like most talk shows did in that era, as whenever it started. As I said, the audience was there as an element, but not a contributing element. If you watch some shows, early shows, you know, from the 60s, popular, you know, talk shows, whether it was a Johnny Carson show, the Dick Cavett show, the David Susskind show, shows like this, there were audiences. Sometimes Susskind didn't have an audience, but Dick Cavett did. He came out and did a monologue, and he sat, but the audience, you heard them. You didn't see them. They didn't ask the guest questions. That was the host's job. When Phil Donahue started, that was the format that he had too. The only difference was that Phil Donahue, rather than just sitting on the set, as he initially did, whether it was his idea or producer's idea, whatever, one day, rather than sitting on the set, with the guest the whole show, and he would do this. He would. It wasn't like he didn't, but he came out and walked amongst the audience with a microphone in his hand as he would maybe ask a question from there. Perhaps it was done as just a, you know, once again in television, to provide a different point of view, to provide a different picture, just visually to shake things up a little. You know, if you're a director of a TV show, you're like, well, how boring is this? It's just, I mean, I'm just on this. The only thing I could do is show three different shots here. I could show the two of the people together sitting in a wider shot. And then I do a close-up of the guest, and I throw a close-up of the host, and then I go back to the two shot, and then I go back to the close-ups. And that's your hour show, right? So perhaps the idea with this was, well, let's just, you know, hey, Phil, get off that set and walk amongst the crowd. You can still ask your questions from here. We have a microphone. They could hear you. But it gives a little, a different view, a little different sense of the picture. Instead of this two shot of just two people for an hour, well, now if you roam around the studio, I get to see some regular people in the audience, and they get to go home and say, oh, you know, hey, Martha, I saw you on TV today on that TV show with that guy with the white hair. It may have just been that simple. And then what made it revolutionary was a simple, mechanical, physical gesture. Many times it's the smallest things that have the biggest impacts. And what Phil Donahue did, once again, whether it was deliberate or by accident, whether it was a momentary, quick little thought, or whether it was a well-thought-out move to try something new, I don't know what the motivations were. But whatever the motivations were, they were revolutionary and historic. What Phil Donahue did, instead of hold that microphone under his own mouth and be the sole questioner of his guest, what Phil Donahue did was break down that barrier. The audience suddenly was not just a passive element of a talk show. The audience became an active element of a talk show. And the simple physical, mechanical reflex action that Phil Donahue did, which changed television, and I'll explain how he did. But what Phil Donahue did, he deserves credit for this. Even if others did it before, there may be some TV historian says, well, you know, the first person, it's fine. But Donahue established it as a mainstay of his show every day and changed the way any TV show, after any daytime talk show after his was done. And then even talk shows moving forward were done. And what Phil Donahue did was take away that microphone from his own mouth as he's standing in the audience, and there's people sitting down. So maybe they're at his chest height. What Phil Donahue did was take the microphone away from his own mouth and lean it down toward the mouth of his audience member and allowed them to engage with the guest, allowed them to add content to the show. Phil Donahue, what his ego or lack thereof, and don't forget, anybody who's on television, anybody who's on a stage, anybody who's a performer, you have to have a huge ego. That's not the point. The fact that you put yourself up and you want people to listen to you and look at you, it takes a lot of narcissism to think that you're that important. It takes a huge ego to do that. That's granted. But at least in a small way, Phil Donahue put his ego aside and realized that he didn't know every good question, that he wasn't the only person who should have the right to talk to this person, whether it was a politician, whether it was an author, whether it was a celebrity. The people in the audience were the ones who made these people celebrities, or made them best-selling authors by buying their book, or made them best-selling or popular celebrities by seeing their movies, or going to their plays, or watching them on television. So their input, their viewpoint, mattered just as much, if not much, if not more, than his. And so what Phil Donahue did was a simple, as I said, mechanical gesture. But what it did was change the outlook on everything the way television would move forward. And that's not an over-exaggeration. He involved the audience. He involved the everyman. He involved the average person. When you watch TikTok today, when you watch people creating content today on YouTube, on TikTok, on Instagram, I argue it's because of Phil Donahue. Almost 60 years ago, when he took the microphone away from him, the preordained expert who had this special access before, there was only a few people who had their own shows. They had this esteemed position. And what Phil Donahue said is, I'm going to share that with the public. I don't have all the right answers. I mean, I don't have all the right questions. These people know these people have their own minds and their own opinions. Why should mine be the only voice on this show? Why should mine be the only voice to ask a question about this? Why should mine be the only one to give an opinion to this guest? I've got an opportunity, if there's, say, 100 people in the audience, to get 100 different opinions, 100 different questions, some that I had never thought of. And by Phil Donahue engaging the audience, by taking the microphone away from his mouth and putting it next to the mouth of his audience members, he changed everything. He gave the audience, he gave the average person a little more power than they ever had in the national media. In the national, you know, you could talk about the old days. Oh, you know, and today, and I sometimes, you know, spout about this being a more traditional, you know, kind of media person, and saying, oh my God, today we have no editors, and everybody's just throwing stuff up at the wall and starting their own YouTube channels and starting their own podcasts, and there's no editors, and there's no confirmations of stories, and there's no real any journalism anymore, because we don't have this layer of filter. And in many ways, that layer of filter is good, and it to me, in many ways, it's vital. But it is, let's be honest, though, it is restricting, because there is an element, as much as we try to have complete objectivity, if on a certain day, whether it was a newspaper or whether it was a TV newscast, on a certain day, for instance, there may have been 21 big stories. Or 21 possible stories that happened in that day. Let's just use that as a number. Well, the news, most newscasts, this is before 24-hour news, don't forget, okay, because once again, that changed the dynamic. But for a great part of the early days of television, from the 40s through the 80s, a good first 40 years, there was no 24-hour news stations like CNN. Ted Turner started that in the mid-80s, early to mid-80s, with the advent of cable television, when it really took hold across the country. But before that, most national newscasts, there was maybe a half hour of local news and a half hour of national news, like with your Walter Cronkites and your Howard K. Smiths and your Harry Reasoners. And there were producers and editors. You had, say, 20 big stories today. Well, we only have a half hour, and then there's commercials, so we probably only have maybe 24 minutes, 20 minutes. In some cases, maybe we only have 15 minutes of a half hour of real news amidst the commercials, depending. So there was potentially 20 stories that were of varying degrees of importance, but at least 20 to say these are legitimate stories that people should know about. Well, you know what? We can't do all 20. So somebody or a group of people decided to cut that number in half. Well, we can only run 10 or 12. So that means that 10 of these potentially interesting and vital stories, someone made a decision that they weren't important enough. Well, what was that based on? Their view of that, of what's important? Perhaps their view of it, their subjective perspective on life? Who were those people? There were people in charge who were deciding what we saw and what we didn't. And there were many stories that never got reported that in today's world would have been, because we have more access, we have more openness. But what Phil Donahue did with the talk show format was revolutionary. It changed the way future TV shows and new shows would be produced. There was suddenly an acknowledgement that the public's view, the public's input, the public's perspective was just as important as the so-called experts, the Edward R. Murrows and the Walter Cronkites and the Howard K. Smiths and the Harry Reasoners. Yes, they went up the ranks. They were seasoned, trained journalists. They were taught to learn. Excuse me, I'm going to sneeze. Excuse me. They were taught how to ask questions and to be inquisitive. Yes, there's an art to that. But many times, an average person can cut to the chase with a question that comes right from their heart, right from their experience, right from their perspective, and cuts through all the BS. And it's right on. And it's honest. And it's true. And it can be piercing. And it can be intelligent. And Phil Donahue recognized that. Whether it was a fluke, whether it was an accident, or whether it was deliberate. By taking the microphone away from his own mouth for the whole hour, or half hour, whatever the show was. I mean, it was an hour, definitely, in its prime. I don't know when it started. It may have been a half hour. But by putting that microphone in and letting the public ask a question to a celebrity or a politician or someone of note, it changed the dynamic. It opened up new possibilities, and it was more democratic. It broke down a wall of elitism. It gave us a chance as a society to hear what a variety of opinions, as opposed to, as I said before, some very maybe, you know, stifled opinions. We don't know what the editors of the television newscasts, what their politics were, but it's impossible to be 100% subjective. So the news that we were seeing for decades was being filtered. Certainly the big news of the day, some of the stories were obvious, but then it's that second tier where you go, well, this isn't important. Well, it might not be important to that person who said that, but it may have been important to 20 million people in this country. Even though, let's say, in the 70s you had 200 odd million, maybe 20 million people thought that was interesting. Well, it never got on because one person or a group of four or five people said, yeah, you're right, that's not that important. Based on what? Based on who? Phil Donahue helped break down that barrier. And that's what made the show interesting and fun. He came up with topics that were very serious at times and very frivolous at times. He was a showman as well as a broadcaster and a journalist. He was definitely, he didn't pretend to be, you know, Phil Donahue, for the most part, did not pretend to be objective. That was another thing. Most talk shows before that didn't deal with controversial issues. They were everybody's friend. They were all happy and smiley, and they stayed away from things that could be potentially controversial, that could be potentially divisive. But Phil Donahue's view with his talk show was, I'm here to get people to engage with each other and talk about their differences. Because they're not. They're sitting in silos. Where are we today? Hello? Phil Donahue was one of the first broadcasters to break down the wall between the media establishment and the public. It broke down the wall. There was definitely a wall separating those two. Ooh, that's Walter Cronkite. Well, Phil Donahue got off the set. Phil Donahue sat and stood amongst the people. The visual of that was important to show that the host did not view himself as that self-important. Like you got that impression when you watched other talk shows that I'm on the stage, so I'm important. Phil Donahue democratized television in many ways. He even took himself literally off the pedestal. He stood with the average people in the audience. He didn't stand up on that exalted stage with the supposed celebrity. So he democratized the entire concept. He democratized the role of the host. He, in some ways, actually devalued the role of the host and enhanced the role of the public's view. That was huge. As I said, now, Phil Donahue was in no way objective. He had a very definitive, liberal-minded agenda or viewpoint. Not so much of an agenda, but a viewpoint. And he made it clear. But he took the major issues of the day, and he would have people that were either sympathetic or completely in opposition to what he felt, and maybe what the audience felt. He would have Nazis on, for instance. He would talk about things like civil rights and abortion and prejudice and nuclear war and the role of women, especially in the 70s and 80s. These were all hot-button, controversial topics. But Phil Donahue was not afraid to talk about those in an intelligent way and involve the audience, involve the average person, not just the experts, not just the well-educated people who did the studies and read the books and wrote the books. They were up there with their attitudes and their sense of knowledge. And then Phil Donahue took that microphone and said, ma'am, you have a question. Sir, you have a question. And that person had the opportunity that they would never have in a lifetime to either ask a well-educated expert on a subject a question or talk to an elected politician who they may have even voted for but never met and never could ask them a question. Or maybe they were against that politician. They never had a chance to confront them and ask them a question that they maybe never had a chance to get excited to talk about a celebrity that they may have admired, or an author that they admired, or a sports figure that they admired. It was a huge shift in taking that elite access that the TV host had and gave it to the average person. And that changed everything. It changed the discussion. It changed the picture. And it changed the way we thought about a discussion could work on television. And suddenly, audience participation became a key element in any show, especially a talk show. Look at today, what happens on American Idol? The fans vote. Yes, there's judges, but the judges' vote don't always count. It's the fans who vote. It's the average people. You can tie Phil Donahue to that. You say, Jim, what are you talking about? Phil Donahue wasn't even on television when American Idol started. Doesn't matter. What Phil Donahue brought to television, the mindset that he brought, can be dotted lined from American Idol and all these competition shows or whatever, can be dotted back. And that's just one example. I'm not saying that that's a great accomplishment. My point is the idea of involving the audience, it changed everything. And then the audience then could react and relate to Phil Donahue better, because he wasn't an untouchable figure. He was out amongst them. So I said before, he wasn't on the pedestal. He was amongst them. He was asking the questions now from where they were sitting. So even if he asked the same question from the seat with the guest, it had a whole different perception now when he asked it amongst the audience. He was one of them as opposed to one of those up there. And that became the daytime talk show format that we still use today. Phil Donahue discovered that and invented that almost 60 years ago, say in 1967 or so. When he had the show was popular in Ohio, and then it really found its national exposure when it was syndicated, when it came to Chicago in 1974. In the same studio complex where Bozo was being filmed. You had Bozo in the morning and Phil Donahue right after him. Sometimes you had the same audiences in the hallways there. You had Phil Donahue walk in there ready to do his talk show about seriousness about nuclear proliferation between the Russians and the United States. And you had Bozo in the other place, just finishing playing the Bozo bucket game. But the Phil Donahue show became a national phenomenon when it was filmed at WGN in Chicago, which had a great reach around the country. And so it was right here in Chicago where Phil Donahue took place and really became a major, major media and broadcasting phenomenon and star. He, as I said, he was also an entertainer. And so, yeah, he talked about men wearing dresses as a fashion thing. That was a famous show where he walked out there with a dress on, like, oh, is this going to be the new fashion? Might men wear dresses? Some, designers were pushing for men to wear dresses. Of course, this is in the late 70s and early 80s when, women's lib was a big thing, and this whole idea of, empowerment and women's rights, and, well, why can't men be more comfortable in this whole thing, Okay, very frivolous, never happened. It was good television. But at the same time, he would also have some of the biggest named newsmakers, leaders, serious people talking about serious topics in order for people to engage. He changed the talk show from being entertainment to be engaging, to be educational and informative, but not in a stuffy way, in a relatable way, in an engaging way. If you watch the show and Phil Donahue is asking these questions, you get, by himself, you get a sense that it might be too stuffy or over your head. But if you see your next door neighbor asking the questions, it's a different perspective that you can relate to. Phil Donahue was bringing huge social and world issues, whether they were war, civil rights, homosexuality, abortion, these huge divisive, as I said before, hot button topics, but he was bringing them into the national debate from a different perspective, from the average person. And that was something new. It was empowering for the public for the first time. And as I said, the Donahue Show then, elevated his star. But as I said, he was a very well-known and very proud liberal-minded person. There, the joke in the 70s and 80s and 90s was, if you talked about, women's lib, or you talked about pro-choice, or if you talked about civil rights, some people would say, what are you, Phil Donahue? They also used to use Alan Alda as that kind of a joke too, because Alan Alda from MASH was a very well-known kind of liberal-minded person who spoke out on a lot of issues. But it was like, what are you, Phil Donahue? So Donahue didn't even pretend to be objective. And that's why he would get in arguments not only with his guests, but many times with his audience members who said, Phil, you're full of BS. And Phil would go at it with, would engage with his audience. And that was new. With the host not debating a guest, but the host debating an audience member. Now, we look back at this 40, 50 years later and you say, well, what's the big deal? Everybody talks. No, that wasn't the case. That's why it was so groundbreaking. What we look at today as commonplace wasn't always commonplace. And Phil Donahue created that. And he deserves credit for that. If you're a fan of Oprah Winfrey, if you're in the Oprah Winfrey, Team Oprah, if you love Oprah, you think she's this great guru, you think you get O Magazine, you watch everything Oprah does, you love Gail, if you are in the Oprah sphere of Oprah knows all, and I love Oprah, and Oprah can do no wrong, and Oprah is perfect, you need to know that there is no Oprah Winfrey without Phil Donahue. That's not my opinion. I mean, it is my opinion, but that's not my statement. That's Oprah's. It's true, but Oprah has said as much. There would be no Oprah Winfrey without Phil Donahue. That's a fact. The irony is that Oprah Winfrey made such a bold statement, but at the same time, it was Oprah Winfrey who pretty much put an end to Phil Donahue's career, which is amazing. The Oprah Winfrey phenomenon, I'm not a fan of Oprah's. I'm on record as saying that. But I cannot deny the phenomenon and the impact that she has. I understand that. I don't agree with it. And I can talk to you for hours about why I think Oprah Winfrey has actually been a detriment in many ways to our society. I'm not saying she's evil. I think she's done a lot of good. But she's also done some harm. That's her influence that we are dealing with today. She doesn't necessarily get blamed for it, but I could point out how you could put a dotted line to her and some of the issues that we're facing today. But But there is no Oprah without Phil Donahue. And the irony is that Oprah led to his demise. He was one of the biggest stars, period, in television, in entertainment. One of the most recognizable faces. He was on the cover of every magazine. Everybody knew Phil Donahue. He was a huge, huge, huge star. And when Oprah became the host of a local talk show here in Chicago that was up against Phil Donahue, on a show called AM Chicago at that time, before it was the Oprah Winfrey Show, she was a hired out of Baltimore, Maryland, to host this show called AM Chicago, which was a daily local, just like Phil Donahue was at WGN in Chicago, which, while the show was syndicated around the country, it was here in Chicago, filmed at a studio at WGN Radio, or WGN Television, on Addison, where they still do the news today. And it was considered a morning talk show. And then you had AM Chicago on ABC, Channel 7. And it was also a locally produced talk show. That was only seen here in Chicago, though. It wasn't seen around the country. But it would be, and it would be quickly, and it would become a steamrolling phenomenon. And what Oprah wisely did, whether it was her idea or the producers, was she put on a talk show in the morning going up against Phil Donahue that was basically meant to be the anti-Phil Donahue show. Phil Donahue, as I said before, used to mix in a lot of different kind of topics. But for the most part, Phil Donahue's topics were about engaging people and informing people and educating people about the big issues of the day. So there's no doubt that at times, he was talking about very complex issues that could be a little heavy for 9 o'clock in the morning. And you have to understand, this is about 40 years ago. You still had a very nuclear family where dad went to work and mom stayed at home and watched the kids and took care of the house. That wasn't that long ago. And so, while women were interested, Phil Downey was a nice-looking guy. He had an engaging personality. They liked to watch him. He was funny. And they liked when he had celebrities on. It was a little lighter fare in the morning. Do you really want to be inundated with talk about nuclear war or, invasions and things like that, or prejudice or civil rights at 9 o'clock in the morning? Well, maybe not, but that's what you had. As I said before, there was only X amount of stations available. You watched what was available. Well, in a master stroke of counter programming, Oprah Winfrey said, or her producer said, when they're going up against Phil Donahue, at least locally here in Chicago, and then ultimately nationally, well, maybe, I understand the importance of talking about civil rights and nuclear war and abortion and things like that. But, sometimes people don't want to hear about that at 9 o'clock in the morning. They want a little lighter fare. And maybe they even, if it was mostly women, they'd like to talk about other lighter kind of fun things, like, gossipy things or voyeuristic things or fashion things. And here you had Oprah, who was a woman who understood what women would want to talk about. And it's not, you can't discount this. And Oprah wasn't a beauty. She was attractive, but she was heavy. And women could relate to her. The women that were at home raising the kids, Oprah was speaking their language. She looked like them, and she spoke like them, and she thought like them. And the show reflected that and spoke to that audience. They respected Phil Donahue, but they loved Oprah. They respected Phil Donahue, but they related to Oprah. Phil was like a teacher. Oprah was a friend. And the friend always wins. So when Phil Donahue had that world to his own, he had that audience. But when Oprah came with this different perspective, from a woman's perspective, by a woman and for a woman, and by a woman that women didn't feel intimidated by so often on television, because it's a visual medium. The hosts of women's shows were always beautiful, perfectly sculpted hair and makeup and figures and dresses. And the average woman was at home feeling a little sloppy, feeling a little inadequate when they would see these women. They looked like they were on a pedestal, that they couldn't relate to them. Oprah, they could relate to. She had weight problems. She talked to them rather than at them. They felt a kinship with her. And that was the main audience at that time. The audience was not as fragmented as it is today. As I said, we were still in a very kind of nuclear kind of family. Dad went to work. Mom stayed home. So mom was at home. Kids went to school. Mom had some time before she did all of her different activities of the day, whether it was shopping, whether it was staying at home, whatever she was doing. That was reality. I know in today's world that sounds crazy, but that's the way things were, and it wasn't that long ago. So that captive audience, they related to Oprah more than Phil. Even though they liked Phil, they loved Oprah. And when that show started to cook, the ratings took off very quickly here locally, to the point where within a year or so they said, okay, this show is ready to go national. Just like they did with Phil Donahue taking a local show and syndicating it around the country. It's time. It's not going to be called AM Chicago anymore. It's the Oprah Winfrey Show. And it went around national, and it became a national and international phenomenon. And ultimately, within 10 years, basically took Phil Donahue off the air. Phil Donahue's show at WGN on Channel 9, when it really started to be a phenomenon of his own, started in 1974, and it was over by 1996. Within 10 years or so, Oprah pretty much steamrolled Phil right off the air. And Phil Donahue's brand of talk show was obsolete, because then when Oprah started to do, and people forget this, and Oprah's done a beautiful job of reinvention, to counter Phil Donahue's more serious kind of topics, what Oprah would do would have more salacious topics. I know you don't believe this, and she's done a great job of reinventing herself, and who knows, for all we know, they've even erased the tapes, but Oprah's first couple of years was trash television. She used to have topics very similar to what Jerry Springer had. It wasn't the quasi-wrestling atmosphere that Jerry Springer became. But in terms of, you know, teenage hookers or pregnant young girls, or my mother is my father, and sex change, and my dad's a transsexual. Those were the salacious kind of voyeuristic topics, and the kind of guests that Oprah had on, in addition to the food and the fashion and the gossip. And meanwhile, Phil Donahue's talking about invasions in Iraq, or nuclear war and kind of serious topics. And Oprah, meanwhile, is it's a much looser, lighter, naughty, salacious, presented by a host who was much more relatable to women who were watching the show. They were the main audience who were home at that time watching it. And it became a phenomenon. Now, once she became this phenomenon, and then other people started to copy her, and suddenly you had, you know, Geraldo and Jerry Springer and Sally Jesse Raphael and Ricky Lake and Montel Williams and Jenny Jones and Maury Povich. Then they're all trying to top each other with salacious and crazy guests and crazy topics. So then when Oprah redefined the genre again, when people were copying her and trying to get more crazy and salacious than her, she already had her fame and her money in the bank. Then she switched away from that salacious stuff and became this kind of new age guru. And talking about life issues and inner peace and all these other kind of, you know, esoteric things that now she's known for. And she's done a great job of redefining. And so people, that's only what people know her for. And meanwhile, the Jerry Springers and the Geraldo Riveras and the Montel Williamses and the Maury Poges of life, they get thrown into this trash talk thing. But I got news for you. Oprah invented trash talk. What she did was smart, was when it became too trashy, when there were fist fights on the Geraldo show, when Sally Raphael was trying to top the kind of crazy, freaky people that she had on as guests, Oprah moved away from that and let them go in the gutter, and she rose above them all and talking about life enrichment and being this kind of, as I said, this new age guru. And she disowned all that. But the thing is that that's what put the money in the bank, because she was playing opposite Phil Donahue, who was being more serious. So, you know, without Phil Donahue, there's no Oprah. And then without Oprah, there is no Geraldo or Jerry Springer or Maury Povich with "You Are the Father." And then look at where that went. You can make a dotted line from the Oprah Winfrey Show in the mid-80s. You can make a dotted line to what the type of topics that Oprah had on her show, to Maury Povich's genetic DNA test, "You are not the father." Oprah's show in the 80s was not that far from that. That's the truth. Look it up. I'm not trying to put Oprah down. She's a masterful entertainer and a masterful broadcaster, but that's where her roots are. There's no Oprah without Phil Donahue, but there's no Geraldo, and there's no Jerry Springer, and there's no Maury Povich, and there's no Sally Jesse Raphael, and there's no Jenny Jones, and there's no Montel Williams without Oprah. She created that other side of the talk show. And then she abandoned it when it started to get too crazy. And now she lives above it all. And as I said, she's done a great job of reinventing it and wiping out those early days. But she was salacious. Trust me. I watched the show. I was here in Chicago before it went national. I saw what she was doing and how she was doing it and how she was counter-programming against Phil Donahue. That's real. But aside from my Oprah rants, because I'm talking about Phil Donahue, I really believe that Phil Donahue deserves to be looked at with the same kind of reverence as some of the greatest journalists and broadcasters in the history of television. He really belongs up on that Mount Everest with Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite. He changed the way we think about discourse in this country. He changed the way television shows are produced to engage people. He really had a genuine drive to get to people, to talk to one another, to stop. We have always been a divided country. It's not just the last couple of years. That's silly to say that. We've been a divided country from the first day they set into the, you know, at Independence Hall to write the Constitution. Before we were a country, we were divided, even before we were a country. And so what I think was so admirable about Phil Donahue was that he wanted people to engage. You didn't have to agree, but at least you talked. Maybe in the engagement, you learned some facts that maybe didn't change your mind, but at least made you think a little more about your point of view. He did different shows with trying to get, you know, don't forget, his show really took off during the mid-80s, early 80s, during the Reagan administration, when the Cold War was at its peak. When the United States and Russia were in an arms race to see who would have the most nuclear weapons, and there was a real sense that we might have a nuclear war. There was a real fear from that. And Phil Donahue put together shows with Russian journalists. I think his name was Vladimir Posner, to try to get Russian and American people to talk, to engage as people. We never knew about Russian people. It was an iron curtain. Russia and the Soviet Union was isolated. It's hard to believe in today's world because nobody can be isolated, but the world wasn't always like this with this kind of connectivity. We didn't know what was going on in Russia. We didn't know Russian people. We knew we weren't supposed to like them. We knew we were supposed to fear them. But we feared their leaders and their government, but not the people. And Phil Donahue tried to get American people to talk to Russian people to show that we're all the same, that we've got the same fears and the same concerns. And I got news for you. The Russian people were just as afraid of Americans as Americans were afraid of Russia. And he tried to break down those walls and those divisions. He wanted people to engage. He wanted people to learn. He wanted to break down ignorance. He wanted people to get educated so they could at least understand what was happening around them, as opposed to ceding the power to the establishments and the government. He was trying to give people more information, to give people more power. As I said before, he democratized broadcasting. And that is a huge, huge accomplishment. And he should be remembered for that. I was, there's so many, I mean, I said that, you know, you can look back, and I would urge you to go on YouTube and look up some Phil Donahue shows and just watch his style and watch the show and remember when it was. It might look very, you know, prehistoric to you now. Or you'd say, well, what's the big deal? Think back when no one else was doing that. He was the only one doing it. And think how revolutionary that was when you watch it. He was a surprise. I remember watching the funeral of Ryan White. Ryan White was a young boy from Indiana, became the face of the AIDS fight in the 80s and into 1990 when he passed away. He was a young teenager who got AIDS and HIV through a transfusion when you know, blood wasn't screened, and he became a national figure for the disease, which was filled with so much prejudice. And Phil Donahue helped to tell Ryan's story and to once again educate people that this was not you should not hate the people that get this disease. We should help them, not hate them. Our fellow people are dying from a horrible disease. We shouldn't be happy about that just because we didn't agree with their sexual preference. These are the kind of things that Phil Donahue fought for. So much so that Phil Donahue was one of Ryan White's pallbearers at his funeral. And I remember this because Elton John became a friend of Ryan White's and a great supporter and counts Ryan White and the way he bravely not only fought the disease, but fought the prejudice that surrounded the disease at the time when we had very little knowledge about how HIV was spread. This poor kid just wanted to go to school. He was banned from schools. People were afraid that if he touched their kid, they would get AIDS. It was a frenzied, ignorant time. And Phil Donahue tried to educate people, say, look at this. He's just a 12-year-old kid. He didn't do anything. He got a blood transfusion. Don't hate this kid. Don't ostracize him. Don't kick him out of school. He's not going to infect your kid. You can't blame people for being afraid, but knowledge is power. And Phil Donahue tried to pass along knowledge above all, and using television to do it in a positive way. Yes, he was an entertainer. Yes, there was ratings. Yes, he was a star. One of the funniest things was when he moved from WGN, he moved to New York to do the show from there in the mid-80s. And he was going to move into the NBC studios at 30 Rock to shoot his show. And it was the same place where, at that time, David Letterman was on late night after The Tonight Show. And Phil Donahue was such a big star that every night, when it was announced that Phil Donahue was going to be moving to the same studio complex where, you know, 30 Rock, the NBC studios, where David Letterman was filming, and David had just started his show, he was impressed, like, wow, Phil Donahue is coming? This is how big of a star Phil Donahue is. Like, oh, my God. They had a Phil Donahue countdown on the Letterman show. Every night there was a big calendar with Phil Donahue's picture on it, and Dave would cross out another day when Phil Donahue was coming to New York and coming to 30 Rock and coming to the New York studios. That's how big of a star he was, that would be a hilarious joke. And Phil Donahue actually came on one time and put an X on one of the days and said, "You are the greatest PR for me I've ever had." But that's the kind, I mean, Phil Donahue had a sense of humor. He was very self-deprecating. He got the joke. He came off as an everyman in many ways. You know, he was from the Midwest. He was a fallen Catholic and talked about that. But he was a big star, but he also had a sense of humor about himself. He can be a very serious guy, and he also could have fun. He could take himself or his topic serious, but he didn't take himself all that serious all the time as well. But I'll tell you, the Oprah phenomenon just steamrolled him off, and by 96, sadly, he was gone. The Phil Donahue show was done. And he came back on MSNBC in the early 2000s with an interview show that was not with an audience. It really wasn't in the Phil Donahue style anymore, because now things had moved from now the 24-hour network, the CNNs and the Foxes and the MSNBCs were now, and those were not built around audiences. Those were built around studios. And so a lot of what made the Phil Donahue show so good, that aspect, that interaction with the audience, that everyman kind of perception, was not there anymore. He was just another talking head, and the show didn't even last a year. And in fact, he was taken off the air, not only because of bad ratings, but because he was against this is in the early 2000s, he was against, you know, this is after 9/11, but 2003, he was against the U.S. invasion into Iraq. And at the time, MSNBC was owned by General Electric, and they were a major defense contractor. So to have someone on their network saying that war is bad did not do good for the General Electric bottom line. Now, you have to understand, if you watch MSNBC now, they are a very subjective, far left leaning news network, just like Fox is a far right leaning network. MSNBC decided to become the anti-Fox. But in about 20 years ago or 25 years ago, MSNBC was a joke. Horrible ratings. No one watched it. It was the joke of cable news. It's only been in the last 10 years or so when Trumpism started, they realized that, okay, we can counter. And they had people like, you know, Rachel Maddow and things like that. But it wasn't always like that. MSNBC in its early days, I'm saying 25 years ago, was the joke of the cable news industry. Believe me. Once again, just look it up. I know this sounds crazy. But learn from history. Learn about history. And so then, sadly, Phil Donahue was kind of gone from the national stage. After that, and it's been a good 25 years. He's done a few different projects, and then apparently he had some kind of long illness, they said. He did win and was awarded in May of this year, just a few months ago, the United States Medal of Freedom, which is the highest civilian honor that anyone can have. And he was in a wheelchair at the time. I'm not sure what he had, if he had any kind of disease or dementia or Parkinson's. They're not really saying. He certainly didn't look the same. I hope he was able to understand what was happening, because he deserved, in my view, he deserved those accolades. He won a Peabody Award for his television work. He's in various Hall of Fames, and I'm glad to know that he got the Medal of Freedom. But more than that, I hope that the average person, and I know this is asking a lot, but I just hope that the average person can realize how important of a broadcaster and a journalist and an entertainer Phil Donahue was. Because whatever we're watching today, whether you like it or you don't like it, a lot of it got its start by Phil Donahue. As I said, TikTok? Yes, I believe you can dotted line TikTok back to the Phil Donahue. Because once again, it took the camera off the host and onto the audience. And what does TikTok do? What does YouTube do? What does Instagram do? It makes the average person the star. Phil Donahue was among the first to do that and do it on a regular basis and make the audience and the average person the star of his show. And that changed our perspective on politics. It changed our perspective on television. It changed our perspective in many ways. It helped democratize television. It helped to give people more say and more power. His goal was to help people engage, to talk, to learn, and to understand each other. Ultimately, so that people can get along better. Which gets to what I said at the beginning. If somebody came here from the 1900s, they would be amazed at our technology, and they would probably be very saddened and depressed at how little we've done in terms of human interaction and human respect for one another. And I really believe at the end of the day, if you strip down to the essence of what Phil Donahue was, he was about helping people understand each other better and live together better, and to enhance and maybe help move the civilization a little forward, as opposed to it either being stagnant or, even worse, taking a step back. If you don't know who Phil Donahue is, I urge you with the most urgency I could give you to please find out about Phil Donahue. Go on YouTube. You have access to that. Watch some of his shows and try to understand at the time why these shows were so important and what he was doing was so different and so revolutionary. If you remember Phil Donahue, I would urge you to go back and do the same so that you can remember and bring back your memories of Phil Donahue and heighten your appreciation and jog your memory. But ultimately, this is a guy, I believe, who deserves to be lauded who deserves to be remembered and deserves to be mentioned, as I said before, with some of the great people that we consider the paragons of broadcasting in this country. I would put Phil Donahue there too. And as I said, if it wasn't for the Phil Donahue, he wouldn't have found the love of his life, Marlo Thomas, whom he was married to for 45 years. They met on his show when she was a guest. And 45 years is a pretty good run for any marriage. And so while he was married once before and he had kids, clearly Phil and Marlo had a great life together. We offer her our condolences, and I think we also offer ourselves some condolences, because I don't know if there's any broadcasters anymore like Phil Donahue. I think he had a legitimate sense of wanting to help people, not divide them, but unite them. And my gosh, can we use that today? Where have you gone, Phil Donahue? A nation throws its lonely eyes to you. And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNradio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And don't forget to tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. Hope you enjoyed episode number 431. I'm Jim Toronto. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, from the end of my mind to your ears.